You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we didn't take a shot every time Brett Kavanaugh said farce, circus, or disgrace. Although if we did, we'd probably still be drunk. I'm your host, Justin Emlesdeski, and if you are still drunk, you're still welcome in the midside as long as you drunk dial or drunk text a few friends and tell them how awesome our show is. We've got you. Just don't puke in our back seat. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I like beer. That's all I got.
That means you have a drinking problem. That's what I heard.
Yeah. I'm also a sexual predator, apparently.
Yeah, we'll get into all this in a second, because all I'm going to say is foreshadowing is I'm straight edge. So this is going to get real interesting real quickly. Also joining us.
Said no Dale's... straight edge person ever, by the way.
That's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah.
Also joining us from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his white male gay privilege, and he especially wants to forego that this week, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I'm gay edge. Is that a thing?
It is now.
Excellent.
What does it mean to be gay edge?
I don't know, but you're going to find out.
Well, it is.
It is what it does, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All of that sounds like the perfect transition, actually, because that's how I felt with the news this week. So let's head into it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Oh, boy. I love the headline of the stories we choose. This one is from a particularly partisan, we'll say, website, but the story is all quotes, so the headline
says it all. Yeah, I just wanted the quote. It was the one article that had the actual quote in it.
Yeah, so the headline here is, creepy porn lawyer Avenatti mocks Kavanaugh's virginity and asks about performing oral sex. The creepy porn lawyer thing, by the way, comes from the fact that Tucker Carlson always calls Avenatti creepy porn lawyer, and Avenatti, the last time he came on Carlson's show, said, I will only come on if you don't call me creepy porn lawyer, so Tucker never called him creepy porn lawyer. Instead, they put that as his lower third in the chyron under the screen.
Well, the guy kind of asked for it. You would think a lawyer would know about all the little ways of doing things and would create a contract that had all the subclauses in it.
So he got lawyered, you would say.
Yeah, pretty much. Marshall and How I Met Your Mother would just look at that and go, lawyered.
Exactly.
For those of you who don't know, Avenatti is both the lawyer for Stormy Daniels and also the lawyer for a woman claiming that Brett Kavanaugh ran along with his friends in high school basically a gang rape ring where they would drug women and then put them in bedrooms in homes and line up outside to have sex with them.
I thought they said they ran a train, like an LGR train.
Choo choo. So definitely not gay edge, Brett Kavanaugh, apparently.
Did before they ran the train, everyone stepped in when it was their turn and they went, I choo 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 you?
I don't know. It's fun that we're making fun of all this because it's ridiculous and exactly what you'd expect from Avenatti. But this story took a strangely personal turn for some folks on this show. When Avenatti was reacting to Kavanaugh's Fox News appearance, where Brett Kavanaugh said that he was a virgin in high school and for, quote, many years thereafter, Avenatti, in an interview on Fox News, said, quote, Kavanaugh, I'm just going to combine the two. That's the strangest portmanteau of all time.
That's when the farce combines into one giant farce.
Oh, man. What a monster Avenatti you've just said, created.
Yeah, but he's going to make a hell of a jurist. Quote, Kavanaugh saying he was a virgin in high school shows he's lying. Does that mean he performed oral sex or had oral sex performed on him? Does he want America to believe that the only thing that he did until well into college years was effectively kiss or French kiss? So this spurned a lot of discussion on social medias and in the Midside thread, where I think Justin is probably itching to weigh in. What say you, Justin?
Well, this pissed me off, and like it hurt me deeply. This like gave me flashback, like nom flashbacks. I was like looking for Charlie's up in the trees, because this is like everything I was afraid of in college, actually. And before I go too deep into this rant here, Daniel, what was the conversation on social media?
Basically agreeing with him. I mean, the vast majority of people said that we now know that Kavanaugh is lying because no one is a virgin through high school and college.
This is why I avoided social media, Daniel. This is why I avoided social media. I mean, literally what he asked. He said, does he want America to believe that the only thing he did well into his college years was effectively kiss or French kiss? Hi. My name's Justin, and yes, that's what I would like you to believe, because it's the truth. Actually, in fact, I kissed a girl in middle school, I kissed a girl the summer after I graduated high school, and then I did nothing all the way through high school and grad school. That's correct. When I say I did nothing, I literally mean nothing. Zero. That's it. All I had done was kiss two girls. That's it, and just kissed them. Nothing else. In fact, this is something that I'm not exactly proud of, and it was something I tried to avoid, but the cover charge was paid for me. The first time I ever saw a woman topless in person was in a strip club on Bourbon Street. It was my brother's high school graduation, or my brother's college graduation. Sorry, high school would be
Wait,
weird.
Yeah,
college graduation, after I had just seen Bill Clinton run across Bourbon Street. Not true story. Bill Clinton run across Bourbon Street surrounded by Secret Service. And my brother and his friends wanted to go to a strip club because they had just graduated, or they were graduating the next day. And they said they would pay my cover charge. So what am I going to do? Say no. So I go in there and I nearly fall asleep. They come over and they like try to make sure I'm okay. Years later, I realized they thought I was passing out drunk, but I literally was just falling asleep.
So you find boobs boring? That's what I'm hearing.
I find boobs that want nothing to do with me boring. Correct. If there's a pair of boobs and it's like, that boobs, they want nothing to do with me. What does that have to do with me? Nothing. Zero. I was like, it was just not a good situation. And that's the thing. This leads into all of the testimony and everything. What world do these people live in? I've always wondered this my whole life. This is why when I was, you know, younger in college, I was watching stupid dating shows, like when MTV had that Next dating show where one person would date five people, and when he or she got sick of that person they were on a date with, they'd say next, and the next person would come off the bus. I was like, what world do we live in where people just hook up with people this easily? And wow, is it really that large percentage of the population? And this really is the question I have for you guys about this. I'm sitting there, and I'm watching a hearing about a Supreme Court justice nominee, and we're sitting there going, do you like beer? What's your sexual history? Oh, you like beer? You're an alcoholic. Oh, have you ever passed out drunk? And then he asked the senator, have you passed out drunk? No, I don't have a drinking problem. Well, neither do I. Maybe, this is what I'm saying, I'm not saying either of those people have a drinking problem. And I'm not saying liking beer means you have a drinking problem. This is why it's going to get interesting, because I'm straight edge. Maybe we as a culture have a drinking problem. If it's gotten to the point that we are now discussing alcohol and sex for a Supreme Court nominee, maybe we've gone too far with our culture. Maybe we need some course correction here as to how to deal with things. Because look, I don't think Brett Kavanaugh did the things he said he did. But the fact is, there are people out there doing these things in college, because we've created this 4-year time period, and it's even high school for a lot of people, this 4-year, maybe 8-year time period, and in grad school, maybe 12-year time period, where people think they can do whatever they want and there are no fucking consequences to it. They just get shit-faced drunk and pass out and black out, and then the next week they're like, you know what? I was just throwing up from drunk, or I don't remember what happened. I think that's a good idea. I'll do it again. Maybe we've gone too far as a culture, especially when You're going to turn around and you're going to fucking defend a porn star as a lawyer, and then you're going to say shit, and then people are going to agree with him, and now I'm the fucking weirdo? I'm crazy. People don't believe I exist. People believe I'm a liar now. It hurt me personally. It really did. And I hate that something in the news hurt me personally, but that's something I was worried about in college, was being found out about it and people being like, oh, you're weird.
Yes, indeed. Well,
that was a lot.
That makes a lot of things. Well, before I continue, I didn't know Next was a TV version of Tinder. I forgot about that.
That was Tinder before Tinder. Yeah, that was actually that. Say what you will about MTV and all these producers and everything, but they do tend to be ahead of the culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let's make it two people on the show, at least two out of three, who did not engage in any sexual activity whatsoever in high school and college and grad school, because that counts me. So it was also a thing where Avenatti claiming that Kavanaugh must be lying because, you know, who, you know, is a virgin throughout high school and college. I suspect it's, I mean, I'm not claiming it's some large percentage, and certainly not a majority or even a large plurality, but I suspect it's probably more people than we think it is. And it's just something that's not particularly talked about, and I don't know why.
Oh, I'll tell you why.
It's not embarrassing to me.
Right, but you don't get cool points for it. What do you get cool points for?
Well,
what do you get cool points for? You know what I mean? What's in the culture?
I was the choir kid who liked to write, so I didn't get a lot of cool points. Anyway.
Well, right, and that's exactly the point. And I don't think, I agree with you, it's not a high percentage of people who haven't done anything, but it's a certainly much higher percentage of people who aren't out there slutting it around like people believe. It's the whole idea of, like, the kids who are out there going, well, I got A's and I didn't do my homework. Or the kids like, I don't do my homework. The people who are saying things the most are actually in the minority, and they're saying it because they want to feel like they're in the majority and they're doing it to feel cool. It's the same thing. It's just, social media only amplifies it.
So, William, are you cool?
Not really. I mean, for obviously gay complicates things a little bit, but I did have a relationship. I think I would fall under the does that mean he performed oral sex or had oral sex performed on him? But that was one high school fumbling relationship, and then I didn't even have another romantic relationship or even kiss a guy like ever until way late in my 20s. So
I still think that counts as, in the gay world, that counts as virginity.
Yeah. Wait, I have a question. When a gay relationship is fumbling around, is it called a butt fumble?
I guess it depends on what you're exactly fumbling. But
it's just the shorthand. Mark Sanchez is just the Sanchez. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's, to me, this is, it's just so strange that we're taking today's standards and applying them retroactively to things. I mean, we used to only see this in academia, you know, people saying Thomas Jefferson was evil because he was a slave owner. And now we're projecting.
Columbus.
Yeah. Now we're projecting like, it's one thing to say, hey, sexual mores were terrible back in the day. But then it's another thing to judge people. Like, even if you believe that he was a virgin or not, like to project today's sexual mores into the past that far. This is like 35 years, right? Wouldn't be, I would expect it not to be as unusual 35 years ago for people to be a virgin well into college. Like, to me, that doesn't seem strange. This was, Adam Carolla has that thing about, mid-Coke pre-AIDS. Well, this was like pre-AIDS, pre-Coke, right? Like, this is a long time ago, right? This is before a lot of things. This is in the midst of the initial part of the sexual revolution. This wouldn't be unusual.
Well, I'm glad you went there, William. You're referencing a recent episode of the Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew show, and I think something Dr. Drew brought up on there is very relevant to the question I asked you guys that you both dodged, so I don't know why we're playing Fox News.
You didn't ask
CNN
me a question.
Right now. I asked you guys both to talk about something. You didn't talk about it. And it's exactly what you're leading into here. And maybe I interrupted you and maybe you were going for it. But Dr. Drew talks about how the revolution of the 60s and 70s, where it was like being free with yourself, has really fucked everything up, where everyone's like, just do everything. And isn't that the problem we have now? Haven't we gone too far with this culture of sex and alcohol? We're drinking of not just drinking, but irresponsible binge drinking, and drinking to the point of getting drunk is now the accepted norm. Haven't we gone too far with that?
Certainly. We've gone too far with it because we've gone too far in the direction of just whim worship in general. I feel like doing this, therefore I should do this. This is what is good for me, which is totally incorrect. It's not your whims that should determine what is it you do, but your value hierarchy. That doesn't mean you can't drink. That doesn't mean you can't have sex outside of marriage. It doesn't mean any of that. It just means that you have to think about it and think about what the consequences are and what you want for your life and who you want to be as a person. I do think, you know, going over into getting blackout drunk on a regular basis, even if you're thinking, yeah, I want to go get blackout drunk on a regular basis, probably contrary to your values and self-interest, even if you're choosing to do it. So there are lines, certainly, but
I will take a hard line stance. It is.
Yeah, the probably was more sarcastic than anything else. I think it definitely is.
William, do you have anything to say about this?
I think that there's an unhealthy relationship with a lot of things that people are taking a short-term view of, short-term pleasure, right? And in the case of alcohol, it can be, it's not even pleasurable, right? It's about disconnecting people from, disconnecting yourself from reality. And that's something I've never understood about drug use, right? That's something that's never motivated me. You know, I've never been motivated to try drugs because I like being connected to reality, right? And I think that Daniel was hitting the point right on the head there, saying the nail right on the head, saying it's about this short-term whim worship, right? It's just sort of following your feelings and not thinking about what the actual value you're trying to pursue is, right? It's the same with sex, right? It is a valuable to pursue. And just taking a short-term view of it doesn't, you know, if I'm going to get laid tonight, is not the right way to find a healthy sexual relationship.
Yeah, because so to take something like alcohol and not the sex route, unlike Justin, I like beer, as I said in the opening. I also like whiskey and other liquor. But my enjoyment of those things started out in a very narrow sense. Like I tried a beer for the first time ever in grad school, and it was a craft beer, and I liked it. And since then, I've expanded the scope of my study of beer such that I pursue it as an actual value. It's not something that I mindlessly consume or I mindlessly participate in. It's something where I'm constantly seeking better. I'm constantly seeking quality over quantity. And so, you know, couple that with age, and my drinking actually decreases over time as I only can tolerate that which is increasingly good.
Yeah,
because
I think I pursue
it as a value.
I get a tremendous amount of pleasure making drinks for folks, meaning not getting them drunk, but like helping them discover new flavors or interesting, you know, concoctions. You know, to me that there's a sort of like, just like with when I cook for folks, it's the same sort of pleasure I get, but, you know, I mix a drink in like a minute and not cook a meal in an hour.
Totally. Totally, totally. There's so many elements of it, and I would be lying to say that the intoxication part of it is not you know part that I enjoy, because it is. But you have to, as you get older, and if you pursue it or anything else as a value, you learn how to refine that, so that I can hit a certain level of intoxication without going overboard, without getting blackout drunk. I've never been blackout drunk, to be clear.
Been blackout drunk? Have you ever drank
too
blacked out?
Beer.
I definitely have been blackout drunk before in college, so that's definitely a thing.
But you evolved.
Oh yeah. Well,
you
I think part of it is like with anything
drunk.
Though, especially when you're young, you don't know what you don't understand the limitations, right? So it's not like I plan to get blackout drunk. Yeah, I do. I think of one time in college. I think that's probably the only time that I've been actually blackout drunk.
You want to know the drunkest I've ever been, Justin? It's funny because it was basically an accident.
I'm guessing I was there.
No, I don't think you were.
Oh.
So the drunkest I've ever been was a total accident. It's a stupid side story, but it's a cautionary tale for Midsiders.
Which it's sort of like Moby Dick.
That's right. It's just like that, in fact. Yeah, the drunkest I've ever been is when I had to read Moby Dick. No, just kidding. So, we'd saw on the internet or something that if you put gummy bears in a cookie tray and then you pour a little bit of liquor on the bottom of the tray, the gummy bears absorb it, and then you have, like, little alcoholic gummy bear shots. This was when I just moved to Tustin, California. And so... here's the part, the cautionary tale part, which is we didn't have a
none
cookie
of it was
tray.
Don't put alcohol in gummy bears or go to Tustin, California.
You can read into those what you will. No, the cautionary part is we didn't have a cookie tray. So Fies and I put the gummy bears in a bowl and put the alcohol in the bowl. Okay, so when we, the next day or whatever, when we revealed the gummy bears, they were like, you know, the size of large grasshoppers now. And so Midsider Adam and I, won't say his last name, sat at the kitchen table where I was renting, and we were just popping these gummy bears, talking to each other, having a philosophical discussion. And I said, I've got to go to the restroom. And I stood up, and my legs didn't work. Because they were probably about a shot and a half per gummy bear. And we were just popping them like gummy bears, just talking. And then I was like, I'm just going to lay here for a while. And... then I got up and everything was fine. I did not black out, but it's a cautionary tale for Midsiders out there. The cookie tray is very important if you're going to do such idiotic things.
Look, I can understand with alcohol, these idiotic things happening like that. I mean, I would have been like, you realize this is why I've never drank. Like, that's just obvious to me why you need the cookie tray. I'd just be like, really? You're going to put it in the bowl? Like, you don't see that this backfiring?
I only thought they'd absorb so much. I'm not a physics person.
I'm surprised they didn't explode. That's what I'm surprised. I'm actually impressed with the durability of gummy bears. That's what I took away from that story. But no, I can understand, like, okay, you know, you're in college, you're free for the first time, you're like, I'm going to drink. And then, like, you drink too much, or you have too much vodka or whatever it is your body, because everyone has different biochemistry. Your body can't handle certain things. And then you're like, you know what? I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to drink that much vodka again because I know what it does to me. But then that'll happen and people will go, oh, no, I'm going to do exactly that again. Because this is to the point now, it's not just whim worship. It's literally self-destructive. We call it self-indulgence, but it's self-destructive on purpose. They want purposeful. That disconnect from reality William is describing.
Yes, purposely blacking out so that they don't have to experience reality. Yeah. It's frightening. Well, some other elements that were talked about during the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing with Brett Kavanaugh were puking and farting, because that's really important. When you're worrying about who's going to be on the Supreme Court next.
By the way, I love the fact that people always said South Park was too raunchy and it was disconnected from reality, and that's why it wasn't funny. Did you see this? Did you see the Kavanaugh hearing?
Yeah. So Kavanaugh comes out in his, and this is a transition, he comes out and gives his testimony. And he opens up with a statement that can be described as nothing short of having righteous indignation. Like, he's angry when he talks about his daughters and his father. He begins to cry. He gets very snippy with the senators when they ask him things about farting and puking and drinking and etc. And so, you know, I turn to the internet and see what people are thinking about Brett Kavanaugh's emotional response here. And we get things like this article, for instance, by Erica D. Smith from the Sacramento Bee. The title is, A Crying Brett Kavanaugh. This is what white male privilege looks like. So let that settle in for a moment. The article begins, in the run-up to Thursday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, plenty of people tried to compare Palo Alto University professor Christine Blasey Ford to Anita Hill. As it turns out, a far more useful comparison would have been the two U.S. Supreme Court nominees they accused of sexual misconduct, Brett Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas. But in watching Kavanaugh sniffle and choke back tears on Thursday as he talked about his teenage years of football, beer, parties, and pricey schools, it became clear that the sorry display was a prime example of how the concepts of privilege and entitlement are changing in this country, and why the Trump-supporting wing of the Republican Party is so freaked out about it. She goes on to talk about how Thomas was using the race relations of the time to sort of defend himself, saying of his committee hearing that it was a, quote, high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who don't think for themselves. She says it worked, but if you fast forward to 2018, Kavanaugh tried to do what Thomas did, but largely failed. Facing credible accusations of sexual assault by Ford and at least two other women, Kavanaugh launched into an angry, indignant, opening tirade of a statement in which he ridiculously painted himself as the target of character assassination stemming from political conspiracy led by the Democrats and the Clintons. This is how the article ends, and I'll turn it over to Justin. She says, quote, "The white male victimhood narrative is prevalent in Republican circles these days. But as the demographics of the U.S. begin to look a lot more like California, it's a narrative that clearly won't last." Justin, say it!
False dichotomy, bro.
There it is!
Oh, man.
Why did I say that? Can you explain that?
No, you have to... You said it! You explain it!
I'm just focused on, in the quote, the California part. If this country's really becoming like California, we're all fucked. Like, yeah. Seriously. That's what they're claiming here?
Ugh. Yes. Yes. So, here's the thing, Justin. White male privilege. His anger, his indignation, was white male privilege. So, if I were to turn to... you and say, Justin, you are a gang rapist and you do not deserve any of the accolades that we've given you in your life. And you certainly don't deserve to be promoted because you are a gang rapist. You should reply how, according to these idiots.
Yeah, yes, Massa. Yes, Massa. I'm sorry, Massa. Please don't whip me, Massa. That's what they would want.
Well, we're supposed to listen and believe, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Listen and believe.
Yeah, listen and believe. To anyone without a penis.
Yeah. No, yes. Look, baked into this whole article is the assumption that anyone with quote-unquote white male privilege is doing this. That if you have money and power growing up, then of course you're going to use that money and power to run trains on high school women. That's what they're saying. Of course you're going to use that power to drink and do drugs. Because that's what you do. This is projection at the most basic level. Get on my case for psychologizing, Daniel, but this is projection. This is what these fucking people would do if they have the power. It's what I've always said. People don't want this collectivist power to right the ship and make things equal. They want the collectivist power because they want to turn around and punch people in the face because they think they've been getting punched in the face their whole lives. And this is a perfect example of it. I knew this exactly. That was exactly what was going to be said. Oh, he's crying not because, you know, he feels bad because he's being attacked unfairly. And this is just so much stress and it's so painful to be attacked like this. I mean, they'd say the same thing to me. Oh, Avenatti's comments, you know, you're not legitimately hurt by them. It's you coming face to face with the fact that your white male privilege is being taken away from you, that you're finally going to have to pay for the crimes that you committed, that you didn't think were crimes and you could get away from. It's the same question I had about the drinking and the sex in the last story. I have the same question. Where is this world, Daniel? Where is this secret world of white male privilege where all white men are going around when they're growing up punching black people and raping women? Was I just so coming from the lower class because everything I have is my dad who grew up poor? Everything I had is my dad gave me, and I went to a private school, but everyone else had the doctors and lawyers as parents? Was it all those kids and those parties that I didn't go to because I was too busy working?
Where the world of Get Out is?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking.
It's in the mind of Jordan Peele and all the social justice warriors who think that this is how it is because exactly what you said, which is that if they had power, if they had quote-unquote privilege, they would hurt people. They would choose to do bad things to people for any number of reasons. I don't think it's that much of a stretch of psychology. Even the usually encumbered Senator Lindsey Graham went off during the hearings, and one of the telling lines of his was something I think you'd appreciate, which is he looked at the Democrats and he said, "My God, you people want power so badly that you're willing to do this, and Lord help us if you get it," or something like that. Like, he sees that it's clearly about power. He sees that this is their vision of a world with power. This is what they would do to people if they had power. I think it's not psychologizing so much as it is a distillation of what the philosophy they hold requires. That's why I'm okay with it. William, this is, to me, the most disgusting paragraph in a newspaper in a long time, and I just, you know, it is an opinion piece, so I get it, but the fact that these are the types of columnists that the Sacramento Bee wants is frightening. Okay, so the paragraph is, quote, "To the loyal populist supporters of President Donald Trump, Kavanaugh succeeded in looking like a victim of elitist politicians. But to the rest of us, he just looked like an entitled, privileged white male, whining because he's unaccustomed to losing anything, much less a lifetime appointment to the nation's highest court that he always expected to get." Now, before I tell you why I thought this was the most disgusting paragraph in this article, I'm curious what your reaction to that sentiment is.
This is blatant tribalism. It is looking, yes. This is something that frustrates me in tons of ways, especially as I work with diversity and inclusion efforts and things like that, where people judge people based on their group identity and don't look at people individually. And it gets in even into, for me, it connects even with the attack on meritocracy. There's no discussion yes. on whether this person earned anything, right? In fact, even yes. mention meritocracy is to is anything from a microaggression to white privilege. And
yes.
And to look at a person, anyone, and say this is a white male, or as a white male, he's not experienced X or Y, is to me just blatantly false. And it
racist.
And
it's racist, William. You can say it.
Well, it is racist, but it's worse. It's a complete erasure of reality. It's not treating people as individuals in a society. And I say that way on purpose, right? There is a constant false dichotomy between treating people as atoms and treating people as a collective. And we are individuals and everything that implies individuals in a society. And to constantly be seeing this debate between treating people as atoms unconnected from a society and as merely members of a collective race or sex or some sort of other crazy identity, it just leads to destruction.
Yes.
You were the one who put false dichotomy, bro, in the outline, right?
Yeah, and that's the false dichotomy I'm talking about, is that we're treating an individual here and grafting all this group collective guilt. Well, of course he forced himself on a woman in high school. All men do that. We saw that in the Fox News interviews last week, right? Or not Fox News, it was CNN, wasn't it, that did those interviews of women and said, you know, do you believe Kavanaugh? And one of them was like, oh, well, this is how men act. It's like, what does that have to do with Kavanaugh? Even if you thought men act that way, quote unquote, again, why would you apply it to an individual you know nothing else about?
Especially an individual who's supposed to be exceptional. So hypothetically, grant them the premise that all men do that. Wouldn't we want our Supreme Court justice to be an exceptional individual, and be the male that didn't do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so all of what you said is 1,000% yes. 1,000% yes. In particular, and I'll just say high level, since you did all the argumentation for me, I don't have to do it. Erica D. Smith, the author of this article, first and foremost, she is a racist, and we should continue to say that over and over again, because this is racism at its core, and it is worse than racism, but it is racism, and she is a racist, and she should be, you know, she should be told as such. And number two, it gets at the heart of what justice is, and that's why it pisses me off so much. Justice. People should get what they deserve to get. Brett Kavanaugh isn't, you know, whining because he's quote-unquote losing a seat that he feels entitled to. And to call it whining, he's been called a gang rapist in the news. His family has received death threats. His wife has received death threats. His character, his whole life has been totally and utterly destroyed for political reasons. And to call that whining, and to say that
his white privilege will protect him.
To say that he's losing something he's entitled to is so anti the concept of justice as to be unbelievably offensive. Unbelievably offensive.
You know who knew this? You know who saw this coming?
Who?
Zack Snyder. Is it a coincidence that people say that Superman and Batman versus Superman is whining and brooding the whole time? Is it a coincidence where exactly what you're describing is what's happening? All the man does is use his exceptional abilities to do what he thinks is right and protect what he sees as the true American spirit, individualism. And what happens to him in the movie? For political reasons, literally, Lex Luthor tries to get Batman to kill him. And who does Batman most closely resemble in that movie? The right wing. Little scary that this movie nails it exactly, and then the real world reaction to the movie shows exactly what you're just saying. Oh, Superman is whining. You're whining if you stand up for yourself. If you were being treated unjustly, which, by the way, was the point of the movie, Dawn of Justice. Superman was being treated unjustly. People were saying he was whining, and that's why it's a bad movie. Because heaven forbid he be upset that he's being treated unjustly. And it's the same thing here with Brett Kavanaugh, who's literally a Supreme Court justice. Isn't this the reaction nominee. We would... Nominee. Okay, I'm sorry. A Supreme Court justice nominee, a federal judge. Isn't this the reaction we would want him to have if he was accused unjustly?
This is the reaction I would want anyone to have if they're accused unjustly.
Yes, and but especially someone with a heightened sense of justice. That's the one thing he should be good at.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not saying his reaction should be to throw 5 touchdowns. That's how I want Tom Brady to react if he's being treated like. I want, when he gets suspended for Deflategate, to go win the Super Bowl. And look what Tom Brady did. This is how I want him to react with that opening statement.
Yes.
Yeah, it is strange that we're supposed to allow Ford to show any amount of emotion, but we're supposed to expect complete detached stoicism from someone accused of gang rape.
Because you assume he's guilty. The only way you get there is you assume he's guilty.
Yeah.
Yes. Which is why Erica Smith deserves ridicule. And she deserves to be called a racist, and she deserves to be told that her concepts here are so contrary to justice that is her opinions are disgusting. I'm not calling for her to be fired because I'm not a social justice snowflake, but her opinions are totally disgusting and should be rejected by right-thinking human beings.
I'm just calling for her to continue to stay in Sacramento because that's punishment enough.
All right, you got me all fired up, so let's bring the mood back down to a low simmer of farce. Just a nice, put it on the back burner, have a nice farce reduction going on. The distracted boyfriend meme, I'm sure you've seen this everywhere. It's a man in a blue plaid shirt turning around and making a face at a woman in a red dress. Meanwhile, his girlfriend, whose hand he's holding, has looked disgusted at him. The distracted boyfriend meme is sexist, says a Swedish ad watchdog group. This is a CNN article. Quote, it's been used to dissect trends in popular culture, wade into political disputes, and comment on the fickle nature of human relationships, but the popular distracted boyfriend meme is sexist. It found, the Swedish advertising watchdog group found that the widely shared image depicts women as a sex object and stereotypes men, violating regulations on discrimination in advertisements. Of course, the meme spread across social media in 2017, becoming one of the year's most popular online memes, and being used by celebrities including Dolly Parton. I like how CNN was looking for an example celebrity who used this meme, and they went with Dolly Parton.
Don't you have to have, like, three if you're going to say including? Or you just have one?
But it's used by a Swedish internet provider, Bahnhof, in a Facebook and Instagram post advertising job vacancies was reported to the Watchdog group after receiving complaints online. So we'll leave that part of it to a later part of this discussion, the complaints online part of it, because this leads into another theme of the show. But before we get there, Justin, how do you so a couple things. It was deemed sexist first and foremost because it treats women as a sex object. And then also because it stereotypes men. So what do you think? Sexist?
What I'm about to say, I thought was going to be my first and only Batman versus Superman reference on this show, but I'm about to reference Batman versus Superman again. And Lawrence Fishburne, when he delivered this line, it just, you know, this is a common saying. It's just he delivered it so well. In other news, water. Wet. Of course the meme is sexist. I mean, isn't the entire point of the meme, and I don't understand meme culture, so maybe William can correct me on this because, you know, he's involved with, like, League of Legends and such, and that's all involved with the internet culture. Yeah, the internet with the series of tubes.
Such a normie. You're such a normie.
I'm such a normie. I don't know about what is it, Kazakhstan or whatever? What is that?
Kekistan,
that's it. They try to Kekistani. The Kekistanis try to follow the podcast on Instagram sometimes, and I'm like, this isn't going well, guys. I think we did something wrong here. So I thought part of the point of the meme and what makes it funny is it's a stupid stock photo, and stock photos are fucking retarded. Go and browse a stock photo website. You would never use any of those ever. So I thought the joke was they took a dumb stock photo, which reduces people to stupid stereotypes. You know, here's the boyfriend who has no tact. Here's the jealous girlfriend. Here's the hot girl who's objectified. I thought that was the point of the meme. I thought that was what it was. And of course she's being objectified. It's one picture. It's one image. And it's to show the guy being objectified. And it's also to show him being stupid, over the top. He's the one being shamed in this. So I don't see how this ruling is anything earth shattering. It's like, congratulations, you figured out the meme. I mean, isn't this how the alt-right took hold to begin with, where people out there on, I mean, this is like the white power symbol, right? That fucking what's it called,
4chan
created. Yeah, it's like that. It's like, yeah, congratulations, you've pointed out what they're doing by creating these memes in Kekistan, right? You've identified it. Oh, if there's ever old white men doing things, it's this fucking Swedish council saying, hey, guess what? This meme is sexist. Congratulations, you figured it out, old white men in Sweden. You figured out what the kids are doing in the series of tubes these days.
That is whole point of the Kekistan meme, is pointing out that it's about free speech, and the joke is the joke in that case. It's very meta, and you're right. The whole point of this image being made fun of so much is because it was exactly sexist.
Yeah, I like, you know, the part about this, the sort of suppressed premise of all this is that Sweden is so out of problems as a nation that this is what they have to focus on.
Well, didn't the European Union try to outlaw memes or something?
There was some regulation.
Yeah, there's a very strange copyright thing going on right now in the EU.
Yeah, and I saw memes about how the EU is outlawing memes, and I was like, I don't want to get involved in this. Yeah. This seems weird.
Yeah, it's weird. So the title of the photo, by the way, like this actual stock image photo, which is by photographer Antonio Guillem, is "Disloyal man walking with his girlfriend and looking amazed at another seductive girl."
Seductive. So
I suspect that the Swedish council could have maybe just read the title of the image and determined what the image was about. I don't know if they had to have an inquiry. But William, this is my favorite part.
I mean, if we learned anything from IKEA instructions, they probably did things in a really convoluted way that doesn't quite make sense.
And certainly didn't include any wrenches. William, this is my favorite part of this story, which because it hits on a theme of the Midside, which is the committee's president and its seven other members unanimously agreed on the ruling, which was made after 15 private individuals raised complaints. William, they had a government inquiry about a meme because 15 people were offended online.
Yep. 15. That was like the entire population of Sweden, right?
Justin, doesn't this fall into our same 50 people
theme
of the internet? Like, there's
Michael Bay read this article and he was like, you fucking idiots. I'm going to go print more money with another Transformers
movie. There was a
movie.
Government inquiry. Money, time, resources, taxes were spent because 15 people online were offended by this image.
Well, Daniel, I'm not quite ready to come out yet, but I got some stories of this kind of stuff going on, so maybe we'll get there one day on this podcast. But so, I can tell you some stories about that, too.
William.
So I wanted to point out, though, too, as someone who agrees women are not sex objects, like, as a joke, but in reality, women are, like, every person can be seen as a sex object at times, and that's perfectly okay. I have to pull the false dichotomy bro flag again. Like, yes, people can be sex objects, and that can be fun. I don't know why
to
we
be
have
clear,
to say
we don't sell
women
false
can't be sex
bro flags.
People saying a woman is not a sex object. I don't care if that becomes a true statement, but I feel like maybe two other hosts on the show would want women to occasionally be sex objects. So I don't understand that. I don't understand what that outrage is for. Women are not sex objects.
If I'm walking by, or a girl's walking by, and I see her and I know nothing about her, she's definitionally an object.
I believe this is probably a discussion, a lengthier discussion for a different show, but we maybe want to get into like these commonly accepted terms that actually don't mean anything or mean... or are just outright false. That would be an interesting
discussion. Or completely straw man. I think that if we get to some rational definition of what does it mean to objectify someone versus what they usually are trying to imply when they use something like women are not sex objects, which is brings in all this other baggage that changes the definition completely.
Maybe also, guys, maybe we could pitch this to the Guys We Fucked podcast and we could go on as guests.
Oh man.
I think this sounds really like this is really up their alley, right?
I wouldn't say anything is up their alley, Justin. That's that's offensive on so many levels.
How dare you treat them as sex objects?
Yeah, because they don't do that to themselves.
Also, I feel like a Guys We Effed podcast could also be like the Democratic Platform show or something. Like,
wouldn't I be the only one allowed on that podcast, the Guys We Effed? Unless you guys are hiding some important facts about your history.
We'll send you as our representative, William.
All right.
Also, I want to make a pitch for a false dichotomy bro flag. But what I mean is like a referee flag in the NFL. And we'll also sell a mid-side whistle. So that when someone makes a false dichotomy, you can blow the whistle and throw the false dichotomy flag.
All right.
We need a challenge flag, too, for when a flag should have been thrown and nobody threw it. And we could just challenge it. But you can only keep it in your sock.
That's right. You can only keep it in your sock. New York, this is a transition that's impossible because it's totally different from anything we've talked about. So here we go. New York becomes the first state to launch mandatory mental health classes in all New York schools from the age of 3. Across New York State, all schools will be teaching mental health as part of their health education this fall. Thanks to a new law that took effect on July 1, all elementary, middle, and high school students will be required to learn about mental health in traditional physical education and health classes. The mandate is intended to help students understand more about emotional and mental wellness and help them understand when to seek help for themselves and others. While the law will give schools and districts some leeway in how they design the curriculum and lesson plans, they aren't entirely being left to their own devices. There's 9 key points or something. I couldn't find all 9, but some of them include identifying signs of mental health problems, resources for help and support, and negative stigma that surrounds mental illness. So, Justin, we talk about mental health on this show a lot, and I think I've strongly advocated that everyone see a therapist, and I mean that just like you would see a doctor, you should see a therapist. Do you think that schools requiring mental health classes is a good step, a lateral move? What do you think?
I think this is a perfect example of exactly how government grows and how it lulls people into a sleep until you realize it's too late. On the surface, this sounds like a fucking brilliant idea. You're like, hey, there's a bunch of people around here saying they have depression. Hey, we have a huge mental health issue in this problem that's especially hurting the schools immediately with all of these school shootings and such. All this violence and the way kids are being traumatized. So you think, hey, you know what? That's great that they're teaching these kids mental health. And then you stop and you think about it and you go, well, why in health class then are they not teaching them about how to do a medical checkup? Why in health class are they not saying, pull down your pants, turn your head to the side and cough?
Oh, let's not do that in school.
Because then you realize it's inappropriate. Well, that's why I use that example, because it's inappropriate, because then you go, who are these people? Why are the teachers doing this? Isn't that left for the teachers? I'm sorry. Isn't that left for the parents and the doctor to do? So medically, we would say that's completely inappropriate. But now we're saying mental health wise, it is appropriate, when really, as you said, your primary care physician should be involved with this, not the school. So again, we have the schools replacing the parents, the schools replacing other infrastructure, and then it gets even worse when you consider that these are government-run schools, and now the government's going to be sanctioning what it means to be mentally healthy or not. And then we get into, is the government going to sanction collectivism? And is the government going to sanction subjectivism and relativism? And it gets even fucking scarier. So that's how it fucking goes. At first, you're like, yeah, you know, get these kids healthy. Make them feel good about themselves. But then it's going to be collectivism as sanctioned by the government. Parents, medical professionals. That's who should be teaching mental health.
Well, I'm not sure there's much to say after that epic rant, but William, to emphasize one of Justin's points...
William, could you pull down your pants, turn your head, and cough, please?
Not until you buy me a drink first.
Yeah, he's gay edge, remember? Yeah. To emphasize one of Justin's points, doesn't this just seem like mission creep for schools? Like, we all think that mental health is important, but schools are already doing so much and failing so miserably. Do they need to do something else that they're going to fail at?
Yeah, I think I get what you guys are talking about here. Like, there's something inherently scary about the government doing this. And I would say, like, pedagogically, how would you even say that word? Like,
pedagogically,
yeah.
There you go, that.
Pedophilically?
Yeah. In that way, I could definitely see aspects of positive psychology being integrated in education. You know, the whole search for meaning and happiness and understanding, like, building a healthy mental attitude. I see that just like you would teach someone PMA. how to memorize and how to... to me, there's an aspect of, like, exercising the mind and increasing your happiness that makes sense to be taught. But then it gets really creepy when we're talking about this is being done in a government school, right? Because we know that's going to be politicized, just like every other subject in school is politicized. You know, we can't teach English. We have to teach, you know, Ebonics. You know, that was from the 90s. We can't teach math. We have to teach new math. We can't teach history. We have to teach social justice. And you can see this immediately being twisted to a political aim. And it sounds very scary. You know, we can look back in history. You know, a lot of the resistance to sexual education in public schools were on religious grounds, right? And while I didn't agree with the religious argument, there's certainly an aspect that was true. The values of the parents here are being discarded, right? And right or wrong, it is not someone else's job to tell you how to teach your children. And that's the thing that is particularly scary here, is we're saying were saying, hey, we're going to give these teachers, which we know vary in quality in the public school system, we're going to have them be lecturing and instilling ideas about mental health. And, you know, this reminds me, everyone has probably had this experience from college, like having friends that are pre-med or in med school, how they, you know, diagnose themselves with thousands of rare diseases because that's what they're studying all day. I can only imagine this increasing the number of people with crazy mental, who think they have crazy mental problems because they're studying this subject.
I was just seeing this on social media the other day where for some reason on the Instagram search feed, fucking Michael Phelps's wife appeared in my feed, and I clicked on her post, and she was writing a post about how tough it is to live with a spouse and challenging it is to live with a spouse who has depression. And I'm like, really? That's where we're going with that? Michael Phelps has depression? That's why he smokes weed? Like, we've seen that with all these people committing suicide, you know, like Anthony Bourdain, and then suddenly everyone has depression on social media.
Yeah. I don't in any way want the government being the arbiter of mental health. I know this is just in schools and it's not like a police enforceable thing in a certain sense, but
yeah,
it seems like a scary road to go down. Recently, a French court ordered Marianne Le Pen to submit to a psychiatric evaluation as part of its investigation into her decision to post images of Islamic State executions on Twitter in 2015. And this is what I mean, where it's like, you have a state ordering a politician to go through mental health exams because they didn't like the stuff she posted on Twitter when she was criticizing Islam, radical Islam. That's a road that seems fraught with totalitarianism to me. So let's keep it out of schools, unless, of course, we're going to privatize them, then I don't care.
I mean, when something is something, is it fraught with it? Like, when you win a game, are you fraught with victory? I just think you're saying it's fraught with totalitarianism. It is totalitarianism. I mean,
again, I'm being more poetic than I am literal. So.
Yeah, and again, I'm just taking cheap jokes off of that.
Yes, thank you.
All right, anything else here? Anything else we want to rant about?
I like beer.
Okay, well, actually, everything we talked about is really relevant to the movie I'm going to review this week. So let's head into it in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. Focused on. As you all know, I have canceled my MoviePass because that service has become useless because they fucked up royally. So I've been taking a deep dive into Netflix, and my girlfriend suggested that we watch a movie called Burning Sands. And initially I was like, this is going to be terrible. And the main reason I did is I thought it was going to be terrible is I thought it was going to be one of these movies where they made it an all-black movie because they were like, hey, we need to push this out really quickly because that's what everyone wants to see nowadays because Black Panther was so successful. But I'm bringing this up because there actually was a point to the fact that it was an all-black movie. So it was set in an all-black school in the South called Frederick Douglass University. It's a fictional college, but they shot it in, like, Georgia, probably at Emory. That's where these movies are usually shot. And in it, it follows the pledge class for this really prestigious fraternity at Frederick Douglass University. But as the movie goes on, it becomes a contrast between what the teacher is teaching these students in class about Frederick Douglass and how he spoke out against slavery in favor of individualism, and how this fraternity during Hell Week and then eventually Hell Night is treating these students like animals because they want collective acceptance. And this is largely what we just talked about with the drinking and the sex culture in college. And fraternities are definitely this way. In the beginning of the movie, they have the beginning of Hell Week, where they're all out by the lake, out in the woods, and one of the guys does something wrong, and the guy makes him get on all fours, and then he starts kicking him in the ribs. So then the friend comes over and gets in the way to take the kicks for his friend, because his friend is of value, and he's standing up for his friend. But because he didn't do what the frat brother said, he was immediately kicked out and said, you lose, you don't get to pledge this frat, because he didn't do what he was told. See how they're just trying to get the individualism out of these people? And then he tries to get his friend to go with him, and his friend just stays. And then that rib injury from being kicked becomes a major plot point throughout the movie and in the climax of the movie. So this movie actually turned out to be very good. It was the ending was very emotional. I don't even want to spoil it for you. I'll just say Burning Sands out there on Netflix. You should go check it out. If you want a movie that celebrates individualism and critiques our culture in a way that's important, go watch this movie. Don't watch it if you're going to be upset at some underdeveloped plot lines. It's not a perfect movie. And don't watch it if you're not going to like a dark movie. This is a dark movie. It's a tragedy. But the subject matter, here's the thing. Here's the difference between tragedy with naturalism and tragedy with romanticism. This is definitely a romantic movie. And in a romantic movie, you make a dark movie when the subject matter requires it. And this is a movie where the subject matter requires it. This needs to be a tragedy, because if you don't show these stories as a tragedy, you end up with what we have with Michael Avenatti saying these things and senators asking a Supreme Court justice nominee these questions. This directly speaks to that, because it even shows the people in the frat in this movie are doctors and lawyers now, and these are the things they did. Again, it's that view of privilege. So I would say to check this movie out. I think it's worth watching. It's one of the better things I've seen on Netflix. Do either of you have any questions about it, or you want to move on to Trailer Takedown?
I have like a 45-second review of the first episode of the new season of Last Man Standing.
Oh, I haven't watched that yet. Was it good?
It is exactly what it was. That's what I'll say.
So I'm in. I'm in. I'm sold.
It's not stellar. It just like... You know, the other channel, it wasn't stellar, but it delivers exactly what you'd expect. The interesting shift in tone is now that Trump is in office. There's sort of a role reversal in a certain sense. Like, Baxter's not always on the defensive, which is interesting. There's a new Mandy, which I don't like. But, yeah, I think it delivers exactly what you'd expect, and it's worth it just to watch the opening scene.
Wait, the younger fashion daughter they replaced?
Yeah.
So now they've replaced two of the actresses for the daughters throughout the series run?
Yep.
That's too bad. I liked her a lot, and she was really cute, the original Mandy.
She did a really great job in that role. I guess she got popular and is doing something else now. So,
Or didn't want to be part of it.
They make a good joke about it, which is funny.
Christine, because they can hear it on the recording, she just asked Daniel William for your edification. She just asked who was really cute. The girl who played Mandy on Last Man Standing for the first six seasons, I think it was before.
Yeah.
You can look her up on IMDb, and I'm sure you'll find her on Instagram. So if you like my humor, I think you'll like Last Man Standing, because the reason I enjoy the show is Mike Baxter says things similar to what I would say.
Yep, he's into zingers, he's into put-downs, he's into ribbing, good old-school ribbing. He's a good character in that sense.
And he's into, like, taking something that's not ridiculous and saying it in a ridiculous way, and people are like, why would you say that?
Yeah. It's amusing. I like it. It's fun, sort of, you know, digestible sitcom humor.
Yep, and right. I've been watching The Dragon Prince on Netflix. It's by some of the writers from the original Avatar: The Last Airbender, and while flawed, it's actually decent. It has a little bit of a slow start, and it sounds like it's going to get another season, which I'm kind of excited about. If anyone remembers, Avatar: The Last Airbender also had a semi-slow first season that really matured, and so I'm looking at that as a show to tide me over for the live-action Avatar: The Last Airbender that Netflix is greenlit.
Doesn't everything get a second season on Netflix?
Hello, this is Netflix. You're greenlit.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just thinking. Okay, Trailer Takedown. If you ever want to see the trailers we're going to talk about during Trailer Takedown, you can always go to themidside.com where we have them posted there. You can even look at them while we're doing the segment right now, so you can watch a trailer before we talk about it. You know, when Trailer Takedown Dan will go, first trailer, which now you know why he does that voice and I don't. You can then pause it and watch the trailer. They're listed there in order.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Holmes and Watson is the comedy film starring Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly that we previously talked about when we did our Rank'em edition of Trailer Takedown. It's just a spoof. It's the two of them as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and they're just doing ridiculous things. The thing that was cool that stood out to me is Braun Strowman, one of the best professional wrestlers on the planet right now, one of the most popular in WWE. This is his feature film debut. I didn't know he was in this. He was keeping it under wraps, and he didn't talk about it till after the trailer dropped. But seeing him in the trailer, I was like, hey, that's really cool. Good for Braun Strowman. I'm glad he's being recognized because he plays like a monster character on WWE, but he's a funny guy when they let him be funny. So I'm glad he's getting a chance in a movie like this. But otherwise, the idea of taking Will Ferrell's style of humor, which is just like base stupidity and people laugh at how dumb and over the top he is, and making Sherlock Holmes act that way, is just, that's completely antithetical to his character. Maybe that's supposed to be the joke, but to me, it's not funny. It's because when I look at Sherlock Holmes, I think of shows like House, and I think of, you know, Sherlock by Stephen Moffat, and I think of undermining that character by trying to make him a buffoon. And it just seems to so wildly miss the mark that's almost in a way offensive. I'm not offended by it, but I wonder if I should be. So this is a tackle for me.
Tackle.
Daniel?
Speaking of House, did you see Hugh Laurie?
In the trailer?
He's in the trailer.
I was too distracted by Braun Strowman. I wonder if they're going to make a reference to House being based on Sherlock Holmes. Because that's really what started this new love affair with Sherlock Holmes, was the show House.
Yeah. You know, I get really pissed at reboots and remakes, but I would take a reboot of House. You know that, what's her name? Edelman?
Edelstein?
Edelstein.
All those Jews have the same name.
Yeah. Shut up. She's on a doctor show playing a hospital administrator. Like, again.
Because when she realized once she left House that her career was never going to be as good. That was her role. And she was like, you know what? This is the defining role of my life. I'm going to leave it before the final season. Good job, Terry Farrell. Way to fuck up the last season of Deep Space Nine. All right. I still have resentment.
I would take a House reboot. Certainly, I would take it over this steaming piece of crap called Holmes and Watson. There have been few movies that I've tackled harder than this. This is a take him to the ground with your full body weight, get a flag for roughing the passer tackle.
Tackle.
Well, it's a good thing Braun Strowman's in the movie then. Maybe he can do it for us. And I would like to say, caveat, I only want a House reboot if it stars Hugh Laurie. I don't want like a House reboot and they're like, yeah. Let's have Schmidt from New Girl play House. Nope.
No. I want Hugh Laurie to come back.
Yeah.
Years later, like, bring him back, you know, after Wilson dies, etc.
Like Murphy Brown?
Like that, but not terrible. Yeah.
William?
Yeah, I think I actually was offended, Justin. I think that it... I'm not a huge Will Ferrell fan. And I didn't find any of it funny. I could barely make it through the trailer. So, tackle.
Tackle! Second trailer.
The Long Dumb Road is a road trip movie about a photographer going out to Los Angeles, and along the way, as he tries to discover the beauty of America, he meets a character played by Jason... I can never say his last name. Fuck it. He meets Raffy from the League. Okay, this guy has literally been playing the same character in everything. He was that way in the League. He was that way on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And look, I like him. He's funny. But he literally, like, I don't understand. Did they hand this guy a script? And he's like, you know what? I'm not going to do it this way. And whatever you write just becomes whatever the fuck that guy feels like doing. Like, I don't understand. It's like literally even the dialogue is the same. So here's the deal. if you like this guy, it's going to be funny to watch Raffy be Raffy for like 90 minutes. And I can see that being entertaining. But otherwise, this looks like just a cliche, stupid movie. And it's like, can we just get a League reboot or maybe a League spinoff starring Raffy if we're just going to fucking pimp this guy out playing Raffy for his entire life? Let's just do it. Let's just commit to this, America. Tackle.
Daniel.
Yeah, Raffy, the actor is to Raffy as Jim Parsons is to Sheldon Cooper. Like, can you do something else, please? Anything else?
Can we put them in a show together? I'd watch we'll that. That'd be entertaining.
We'll just call the show Typecast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if it was a show? Actually, we need that. Let's pitch that. Okay, whoever Hollywood is listening out there, we're pitching this show. It's a show called Typecast, where Jim Parsons and Jason, whatever his name is, try to go around and act like themselves all day, but everybody just wants them to act like Sheldon and Raffy. That could potentially be very funny.
It could be. I'm sure we could have some guest appearances by any number of people.
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton. Yeah. The Long Dumb Road looks basically like what its title implies. The trailer was horrific. The jokes did I especially like it when they like put out a quote from like a reviewer and it's like, "This is super funny," and then the scene they cut to isn't funny at all. That's my favorite. This trailer is full of that crap. This looks totally dumb. I like Raffy in the context of shows like The League, where there are little bits of him and he interacts with all the other main characters. But to watch a full-length feature film where he is the main character? Jesus!
To be fair, he's not the main character. He's not the protagonist. He's the guy who helps the protagonist see the light, which is the other thing. How fucked up is it that in today's world, the guy who helps us understand the world and its beauty is Raffy?
Yeah. Do you like coffee? Because I can take this caffeine and inject it directly into your eyes.
You'll see colors.
Like, Jesus, no. Tackle.
William?
The only thing this preview succeeded in was make me long for an actual buddy comedy movie. Like, there was nothing funny in the preview. It just made me feel that tug of, like, where are the buddy comedies, the heartfelt buddy comedies? This premise could have been something, but it's not. Tackle.
Yeah, give me another Rush Hour over this.
Third trailer.
Mid-90s is the writing and directing debut of Jonah Hill, who everyone knows. I love Jonah Hill. He's a great actor. He's very funny. I've loved him since his small roles in 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. And this movie is about a kid being a kid. There's literally nothing in this movie that I'm like, yeah, that's interesting and that's different. It's just like, hey, you're a kid and you think life's hard and everyone thinks life's hard. So we're going to make a movie about it. This is another example of what I'm talking about, where it's like at a certain point, comedic actors are like, hey, I need to show I can be serious too. And now we're starting this new trend. We saw Bo Burnham do it with, what was it, Eighth Grade, where we have these movies where it's like, hey, I'm a comedian, so now here's a serious movie about growing up, because I want comedians to make serious movies about growing up. The only thing that makes this movie just a meh, rather than like an offensive tackle, is that Eighth Grade already came out and has like a weird undercurrent of pedophilia about the way it's gone about. And this is just like, hey, here's a kid being a kid. Otherwise, if Eighth Grade hadn't come out, I'd be weirded out by this movie, which again shows us the state of our culture. Still, this is a hard tackle for me.
Tackle.
Daniel?
This is one of those naturalistic slice of life movies that I don't even understand how they get made. Like, are there people who actually sit down and enjoy watching this? Just watch a documentary about the 90s. We don't need to fictionalize it into nothingness. Like, stuff actually happened in the 90s. You can go read a book about it, or,
you know. Watch VH1, I Love the 90s.
Yeah, anything that's not just watching a plot where nothing happens but it's set in the 90s. Also, I'm curious, so we had Stranger Things in the 80s, now we get the 90s, we need a good 2000s movie, and then eventually we're just going to get to the point where they're just, we just go to movies and they're just scripting real time. I feel like this trend of this, we can do the 90s perfectly or the 80s perfectly, it's kind of you know, effed out already, and I'm sick of it. So, guess what? Tackle.
Tackle.
William.
Skateboarding is fun. Tackle.
Tackle. Final trailer.
Hellfest is a horror movie about kids who go to, well, teenagers, who go to something similar to Halloween Horror Nights, Hollywood Horror Nights, depending if you're in Florida or Hollywood, or Not Scary Farm, or Six Flags Fright Fest.
Or, hold on, the best one, Cedar Point, Hollow Weekends.
Okay, fair enough. I've never been to Cedar Point. This is my coast by. This is what happens when you're in California too long. You forget there's like a great theme park in the middle of the fucking country. Right?
You forgot there's the best theme park in the middle of the country.
I believe you. I will take your word for it. You are a roller coaster theme park aficionado. I will take your word for it. So yeah, that's what happens. So like any of these parks, like Cedar Point, what's it called?
Hollow Weekends.
Like Hollow Weekends at Cedar Point, they go, and in the scare zones, there's someone who's actually killing people. Now, I'm going to get out ahead of Daniel and William here, although I don't know, William might say something similar to me. Daniel, I know you're not a big horror guy, but I watched this trailer, especially after watching the first three, and I go, thank God, someone is at least fucking trying to make a movie that's not reality and make a movie that has something to say, and then a movie romanticizes a trend in reality and makes some sort of statement about it. This trailer to me seems to be like the danger of becoming desensitized to horror, where you literally go to these zones where people are scaring you, but you're not scared of them because you know that they're not really trying to harm you, even though it's like they're dressed like the Purge and they're holding like giant guns and giant knives. So I appreciate this. This is a movie that I would enjoy because horror is the one genre where people are still trying to make statements about what is true and what is harmful, and they're trying to stylize it. Hug.
Hug.
You can go dump on this now, Daniel.
Hug. Yeah. So I will grant you that of the four movies we're reviewing, this has the best premise. I don't think I've quite seen this premise, although I'd say it's probably an evolution of some things. I have a question for you. I don't know if you know this or if anyone did research. So this trailer is very stylized and it's labeled a throwback trailer. Is the whole movie like this, or did they just do a trailer in the style of the early 80s?
I don't know. I'm going to look that up. But to answer your other question, this is similar to the premise of the book Horrorland in the Goosebumps series.
Yes. Thank you. I knew there was something from my childhood that this was kind of mimicking, but I couldn't pinpoint it. That being said, I just don't get it. Like, it's all the same to me, even though the premises are slightly different. It's all teenagers, it's all murder, it's all we run away, one of us is a virgin, the black guy's gonna get killed first, we all know, etc., etc., etc. I just feel like this, I don't know where this genre goes. Yeah, I think they are trying to do sort of some social commentary, but to me it just seems like the same, even if you're trying to make social commentary, it seems like the same formulaic execution of that commentary. Tackle.
I mean, I watch professional wrestling. You want to talk about formulaic? I think I have a tolerance for formulaic.
And you made fun of Midsider Elliot for watching procedurals.
Exactly, exactly. Last time I hung out with Elliot, he recommended another procedural. So
you gotta love his consistency. Say what you will about Elliot, but you gotta love his consistency. As far as your question, I just pulled up the other trailer and I'm watching it on mute. They still have a lot of the color stylization, but I think the main thing is that stylized is the announcer. The voiceover was sort of like a grindhouse announcer in that throwback trailer. I think that's why they're calling it a throwback trailer.
Okay. Yeah. All right, William.
All right. I actually agree with you, Justin. I kind of like the trailer. It seemed interesting, but I don't like these kinds of movies for the same reason that Daniel said. So for me, it's on the knife's edge. So I'm going to give it a soft tackle.
Tackle.
Oh, man. I mean, first of all, I want to say that Happy Death Day is one of the best movies to come out in recent years, and that's a horror movie, so go watch that. but you should have just hugged it because you both triggered the all tackle rule. So you're going to hug it anyway. So Daniel William, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess it has to be this one. I was going to try to find a way to finagle watching Holmes and Watson because I know Fiza is going to watch it because she has the movie choice of a 16-year-old boy. But no, it's definitely Hellfest.
If she has the movie choice of a 16-year-old boy, does she get blackout drunk and gang rape women?
I knew we were going there. No, it just means that she's really into like the Fast and Furious movies and you know, Will Ferrell and all that stuff. So,
well, in a controversial pick, I'm going to pick the 90s because I can just turn my brain off and watch some skateboarding.
You can't see me because it's an audio show, but I'm shaking my head right now. Neither of you Hellfest. Neither of you Hellfest.
I did. I said Hellfest, ultimately.
Okay. Fair enough. I did. We'll take it. All right. Well, sort of relevant to what we've been talking about, there's an observation I've had throughout my life that I think kind of started synthesizing, or maybe I finally came to a realization to this past week while I was driving. And I want to touch on that in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. So my girlfriend for the moment lives about half an hour away. So often on, you know, Friday nights, Saturday mornings, I'm driving to and from where she lives back to my place. And it's largely the suburbs. And I say, quote unquote, the suburbs. And I said it in that way. And I'm doing air quotes right now because in California, everything is the suburbs, really. I mean, there's like the small downtown LA and then there's the sprawling metropolis of suburban life. And I had this feeling, and it's this idea of being just a number. And it's, you know, it's something that dissuaded me from going to like a large school or living in like a large city. And it's the idea that you don't matter because you're just a number. You're just another person on the assembly line. And that's really what I realized. I was like, part of the reason I don't like life in Southern California is it's a culture that feels like just a number. And that's sort of what I want to ask you guys about and see and get your thoughts on, if this is related to the issue of collectivism or the issue of a giant government, because I think it may be related to the idea of you're being told you have to help other people and you have to contribute your fair share and it takes a village, because then you're reinforcing psychologically that what matters is not what you yourself do and what you yourself want to value. It then what's being reinforced is what matters to the group, what matters to the state, what matters to the city, what matters to the collective. And I wonder if that's how it manifests sort of on a psychological level, which obviously would then lead to sort of like a depression, because I feel that way when I feel like I'm just a number. Like I have fear and dread. You know, that's what I was saying about the city. One of the reasons I never wanted to live in like a New York City is the idea that it almost feels like an ant colony to me, where you have like your small box and then like someone can like observe where you're going. And like, that's what you have. You just have that small box that you live in. But on the other hand, some people see New York City as like this celebration of individualism. I mean, Ayn Rand saw it that way. So what leads to those different psychological viewpoints? And do I suffer from that because I've been in such blue states for so long in my life?
Well, to be clear, I don't think in California you're a number. I think in California you're a sack of money. And the whole goal of the government in California is to extract as much of that money out of the sack as possible.
Well, if you are a number, it's your bank routing number.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, that's part of what I'm referring to when I say just the number. You know, it's like when you go to a school and like they're not actually trying to help you. They're just trying to, you know, it'd be, you know, they're not trying to help you get a good education. They're just trying to get you to pay tuition and then leave. So they just give you a degree. They don't really care if you learn or not. The teachers don't care if you learn. It's like going to a theme park and they're just trying to get you in and out. They're not really worried about your experience.
Yeah, I think you're touching on something, and you kind of made a reference to, you know, why you didn't go to a big school. I went to a big university from a really small town, really small school. You know, there were 68 people, I think, that graduated my senior year from high school. And then I went to University of Michigan with, what is there, 20,000 students, something ridiculous, right? And one of the ways that I kind of coped with that change is really cutting through the sort of that back to the core of what we've been saying in the, earlier in the episode of the that dichotomy of like, are you just an atom or are you a part of a collective? And the answer is no, you're an individual in a society. And what I mean by that is like I remember joining the Michigan Mars Rover team and really, you know, contributing to that and feeling that community aspect of facing a problem together and trying to solve a problem together. That was really important to me at Michigan. And then when I moved to Baltimore, I started to feel that sort of same emotion that you were describing. Like I'm just a part of this like big city machine and not really, you know, don't feel connected. And then that's when I started the Charm City Objectivist group in Baltimore. And I think that, it's a good thing to notice about yourself, because again, we aren't just atoms, right? We do need to connect to other people that share our values. And when you're in a city, especially like California, is much different than the Midwest, where people do tend to be social and more friendly on the outside, and that can lead to easier connections. I think in California, it's a lot more work in Southern California to make those genuine connections. I mean, first of all, you've got the LA fakery to get past, but then you also have this very insular, and it's common in a lot of large cities, this very insular, like, these are my friends and I'm protecting them from, you know, ever mixing with other groups of friends.
Yeah, to put a very explicit point on that, William, I don't think it's necessarily, you know, like the size of a city or, you know, a city per se that creates this feeling of alienation, although it could add to it, you know, infrastructure problems, etc. It's sort of the culture of the people. And that's difficult to sort of discern exactly how that comes about. Certainly there is a relationship with how the city is structured.
Oh yeah, certainly the way, the impossibility for me during the weekday to get from Santa Monica back to where I live in Lawndale, that certainly contributes to, you know, me not going out and socializing during the week back in Santa Monica, because in order to come home, walk and feed a dog and get back to work, that would be a 3-hour drive.
Well, that's one of the reasons that Fiza and I chose to leave LA when my major contract was up there and move to Austin, which is we found ourselves becoming hermits because we lived in Culver City, which is sort of central to all the major areas of the LA octopus. But we'd find ourselves saying, like, someone would go, well, there's a new restaurant open. It's really great. And we go, well, how far is it from where we live? And like, it's 4 miles. It's like, oh, we're never going.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. Well, we're never going. That's 2.5 hours. Like, we're just not going. So forget it. And we found ourselves just staying home or going to the same place over and over again. But Justin, like, when we moved to Austin, which is not certainly nowhere near the size of Los Angeles, but it is a big city and it is a congested city, it still didn't feel alienating because, to tie in William's point, people there would talk to you, ask how you're doing, what your day is like, what you do for a living. They were interested in because you were in Austin and your neighbors, and they were interested in their communities. And it was such a totally different feeling from living in Los Angeles, where people just had this straight ahead bubble. And even if you did interact with them, they would have this, oh, yeah, nice to meet you. Great. Yeah. Okay. So on. Yeah. Let's get a drink. And then you'd never hear from them again.
Yeah. There's a kind of benevolence that is definitely different in a different degree, depending on the you know, I've lived a bunch of places in the U.S. And the sort of gentle benevolence of like, hey, these minor interactions with random strangers in my community is a positive, is just not true in L.A. And it wasn't really that true in Baltimore either.
No, in D.C., there's even a little bit of hostility to it because I think the city is so transient. Like, people are here on average for something like 2.5 years. And it's sort of like, why bother to make friends? Why bother to have relationships? Because I'm never going to see these people again anyway. And I don't know if that's I don't know if it's exactly like that in LA. In LA, you have the alienation of, I'm just never, if this person lives more than 2 miles from me, I'll never see them again.
Right.
It's just not possible.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with the like I said, the sprawling suburbia of it, where you just find your little corner and that's where you stay. And then you don't like people who come there who aren't. You, hey, Santa Monica person, your kind's not welcome around these parts.
Take your plastic straw and shove it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that as well. William, it's funny what you're saying, because I'm not surprised you had that experience in Baltimore, the most naturalistic city in the country.
Hey, Baltimore's the city that reads. Park bench, I don't know, that's what the park bench said. I think it was like a more of a hopeful statement, because we all know that's like the illiteracy is like one of the highest cities is Baltimore. So,
yeah, and I mean, Clemson had like 16,000 people, right, Daniel? And that's probably where I felt like the least like a number anywhere I've been in my entire life. So,
well, yeah, the thing, yeah, totally. That's an excellent point. The community in Clemson, I believe the number was the town of Clemson had 11,000 people, and the university, all told, students, faculty, administration, had 30,000 people. So it was just, you know, massive when people were in town. And people were so ridiculously connected there because they had a sense of community about them that it was totally unalienating. You were connected in every way. And it just, it was awesome. I've often said I would love to retire to like Greenville, for instance, South Carolina, because of the community element of it. So
do you think any of this has anything to do with, like I said, the collectivism or California seeing you as just a pile of cash as a bank account routing number?
Yeah. I mean, again, sort of it's hard to say, because the culture and the politics and the ideas are all reciprocal and they're all feeding off of each other.
Right. That's why it's my question.
You know, the thing that Gavin Newsom, the guy who's going to be your next governor, said on the Adam Carolla show, like, oh, one thing I really like to put on the signs, you know, for traffic is you're not in traffic. You are traffic. And it's like, well, way to completely decimate individual values and just be like, no, I need to get somewhere. It's like, no, you're causing the problem by existing. You are traffic. And I just think that that's the mindset of the city. And it comes from the fact that people vote these idiots in because they feel like they have to overcome this numberness by helping others. I don't really know. It's a strange thing. I think the study of alienation is a very interesting element of psychology, and it's one I'm certainly not an expert in, but one that you could do a PhD in, I'm sure, Justin.
Yeah, and that's what makes all of this so challenging to figure out and understand and talk to people about. You know, we always talk about individualism and how important it is, but then we're also sitting here talking about community and how that makes you feel like more of an individual. And on the surface, that seems like a contradiction. It seems like collectivism would go more with community, so it can be very confusing on a surface level.
Yeah, it's a really hard topic for people to wrap their brains around, especially when they're new to these kinds of ideas of radical individualism. It's the same thing when we talk about selfishness and people put the false dichotomy between the wolf and the sheep, right? And that's not, it's the same error, is that in order to be a flourishing individual, you do have to connect to other people that share your values. And even if that's value is simple, and I'm putting that in Joey air quotes as well, as simple as being part of the same community.
That is
it's related, I think, to, wasn't it a professor that you saw at Clemson, Justin, who made a comment about how socialist countries tend to make people hate each other more so than individualistic countries?
That's exactly what partially inspired this. And I think watching that speech led me to sort of these conclusions. I mean, it only took me 10 fucking years, which proves he's the genius and I'm not. But that's exactly what I was thinking about, is that socialist countries actually make you more envious and actually make you less of a community, because you're always worried about comparing and you're always worried about everybody else having more than you. So it's not I have what I want and they have what they want, and you're not comparing because there's no point because everyone has different values. It's the assumption that everyone has the same goal and everyone wants the same thing. So then it's not the traitor principle anymore. It's every man against each other.
Yep. I think Ayn Rand poetically summed that up by saying that in collectivist societies, you're always envious of someone who has a dollar more than you and fearful of someone who has a dollar less.
Okay, now that is the way to poignantly end this. Although I will say on one other thing when we're talking about Rand, I think that Starnesville is the entire state of California.
Yeah, pretty much. It's going certainly, that direction.
It's certainly the homeless encampments around my work in Santa Monica.
They're not homeless people. They're people who choose to live without structure.
Yeah, you can't say homeless encampment. That's not what you're supposed to say. I keep forgetting what you're supposed to say. I literally can't remember the term. People keep telling me you can't say homeless encampment, and I can't remember what I'm supposed to say because it's so retarded to me that my brain won't accept it.
The differently domiciled.
They have some term for it. I can't remember it, but my brain.
Come on,
will
if we can say differently
it.
Abled, we can say differently domiciled.
I like it.
All right, gentlemen. Let's bring an end to this episode. What did we learn this trip? Who goes first? Daniel? I forget. Yeah. Oh, William. No, we'll go with William. All right.
Well, I learned that California is falling behind New York because New York is indoctrinating students as young as 3. So you hear that, Newsom? It sounds like a good plank to run for governor on.
Daniel?
I like beer. No, I had a... Actually, I wasn't in the stories, but I had an Ayn Rand moment where I thought to myself when Jeff Flake at the very last second decided to literally flake on the Kavanaugh vote and demand an FBI investigation, that if Ayn Rand had named a character Senator Flake who acted as such, people would have mocked her for being too on the nose.
Especially because she's Jewish.
Zing. Wow, once again, showing that... reality can be way more bizarre than fiction.
I have a question. I'm going to call you on this right now.
Yeah.
Did you have that thought before or after our phone conversation?
Which one?
The one where I called and I was like, hey, what's going on? Is everything okay in DC? Like, what's the update? And then you told me about the whole Jeff Flake thing. And I was like, okay, is that real? Is that really his name? Is someone trolling us right now? I was like, this is a simulation, right? Elon Musk was right. Right? This proves that?
I don't recall, because I don't remember the exact timeline of things, but I remember that it all hinged on Flake, and he's the flakiest of the Republicans, and it just it happened that he lived up to his name, and it was all very strange. I don't think it's necessarily Elon Musk. I think who was the other one who wasn't Musk, who declared that everything went to hell in the universe after we turned on the Large Hadron Collider. They were basically living in multiple parallel universes simultaneously, like the election of Donald Trump and the Red Sox win, or not the Red Sox, the Cubs win the World Series.
Well, and, it was the Red Sox first and then the Cubs.
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. Like, so maybe that's it. Maybe we'd turn that thing off and go back to reality.
Yeah, I didn't know we were living in Donnie Darko now.
That's right. It's a mad world. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that now everything has turned around completely and no one's ever going to believe that I was a virgin and inexperienced for as long as I was.
There you go. Midsiders, we hope you learned something this trip. You can tell us what it is on all the social medias at The Midside. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Vero, Snapchat. Do people still do Snapchat? I feel like it's declined precipitously.
No, it died because they did that random feed where they're like, hey, here's a bunch of random people you've never heard of and might care what their snaps are, rather than having that cool feed that showed all like the sponsored channels. Now it'll be like, here's a few sponsored channels and here's a few attention whores.
I think you can just say whores. So you can find us on all the
can you say whores
still.
And not be fired?
Oh.
No, I can still be fired. I'll definitely be fired. It's just a matter of time. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the past episodes of the show, including the Snyder series and Nolan Notes and all the special episodes we did and all the regular episodes we've done. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play and get the show delivered on Midside Monday, the moment Justin hits publish. You can be the first to listen. While you're there on iTunes or Google Play, give us a 5-star review. That really helps. It does pretty significantly help. It helps in two ways. One is it actually helps us go up the search term rank. So when people type in welcome to the, or if they just type in the Midside, we can appear first or whatever it is after.
Well, if we're not appearing first when they're putting in the Midside, we've done something terribly wrong.
Yes, we do appear first for that, but I want to appear first when people type in welcome to the, which right now we're losing out to Night Vale, whatever the hell that is. So you can leave those. And there's another way that the reviews are helpful, which is that it gives me a ridiculous endorphin boost every time someone says something nice about the show. So please do that. You can listen also through Liberty.me, Libertarian Podcast Network that syndicates us. Thank you to our libertarian friends. Oh, I had a story, quick story about being a number, Justin, which is that when Trump was nominated to the Republican Party, I renounced my membership and joined the Big L Libertarian Party. And I just got an email from them saying, hey, comma, 1611211, your membership has expired.
That's ironic.
The Libertarian Party refers to me by my membership number. Awesome. Good job there. Good marketing.
Are you Liberty joining that number?
I guess I am Liberty 116211. Yeah. So I will not be rejoining the Big L Libertarian Party, as Gary Johnson was a joke of a candidate. So I am without a party. I may not vote ever again. Thank you, Justin. What was I saying? Oh, you can also go to Patreon.
You're saying that I was right about the never voting again thing.
I think so. It depends. It depends on a couple things that are going to happen in the next couple weeks. We'll see. So patreon.com/themidside is the network for people who want to help us financially, i.e., you choose to give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. We love that. We love our Patreon subscribers. It helps us keep the lights on. Helps us buy advertising, pay for hosting, websites, and all the other tactical crap that Justin does that I don't do anything with. And there are Patreon exclusives, right? Like, we do exclusive reviews of movies and things that are for only Patreon subscribers. And that leads me to our Discord channel. You can go to Discord and join or ask William. I don't really know anything about that. But there's a Patreon exclusive section where our Patreon subscribers can talk to us personally. You have immediate access to our minds. And you can recommend trailers for Trailer Takedown. You can recommend stories. And you can always submit things to me on Twitter for Woker Joke. Something we should mention regularly. But if you can't do any of that, if you don't have time, you don't know what Discord is, you're like me and you feel like an old man when it comes to this newfangled technology stuff, which is should be frightening because I do digital for a living, just tell a friend about the show. Just tell a friend, hey, Google the Midside and listen to this podcast, because these guys are hilarious / strange / awful / correct all the time / idiots. Whatever it is, whatever the reason, tell your friends, get more people listening to the show. It's how we grow the Midside. It's how we create more Midsiders. And eventually we're going to have to come out with our own fermented apple beverage called the Midsider.
God damn it, I was just going to make that joke.
And yeah, until next time, I like beer.
By the way, that's actually what it says at the top of my resume. It says correct all the time / idiot. So they know what they're getting into when they hire me.
False dichotomy, bro.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
By the way, I've had this on repeat for a while. I don't know if anyone's been on Instagram recently, but I pulled it up, and there's a video of Tom Brady with his kid, and the kid has a Tom Brady jersey on, and I don't know. I just, for some reason, I think that's the coolest thing ever.
That's awesome.
I'm just trying to think, is Justin imagining his kid wearing his jersey, or is Justin imagining being the kid and wearing Tom Brady's jersey?
Or am I imagining fantasy? Having a kid who's wearing a Tom Brady jersey?
That's true.
We have a little Tom Brady onesie for Isaac, but he's too small for it still. It's like, it looks like a bathrobe on him or something. So we're waiting for him to get a little bit bigger.
Well, you got
to
fatten him up. But
I'm trying, man. I mean, I don't have any milk, but, you know.
You got to grow into being able to have a Tom Brady jersey on.
Yes, indeed.
You have to earn it.